others don't? Where does it come from, and who's responsible for developing it? Is it students' responsibility? Is it teachers? How is it developed? During the call, if you think of a question, please just email us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and I will pose those to Bethany when we get to our question and answer time. I know everyone's time is valuable and limited, so I'll get right to introducing our speaker today. Dr. Bethany Tucker is from North Carolina and has been a professional educator since 1972. She has served as a classroom teacher, a resource teacher, a teacher of gifted students, program coordinator, grant fund project director, and is currently a professor of education at Everett University in Danville, Virginia. While teaching at Everett, she researched and developed Tucker signing strategies for reading, which is a decoding method using sight, sound, and movement that has been highly successful with struggling readers nationwide. Through AHA Process, Bethany provides training and consulting services for reading, a framework for understanding poverty, learning structures, and under-resourced learners, and the most recent one is she also does consulting on motivation. Bethany is an experienced consultant and has presented numerous workshops for AHA Process since 2000. Bethany will be offering an online course on November 4th and 18th from 4 to 5 p.m. Or 4 to 5:15 p.m. Central Time on motivation. And if you'd like to sign up for this great opportunity, when we emailed you the information about this teleseminar, we also sent you a special. And that special is only good for teleseminar attendees. So you might want to click on that link and take advantage of the special deal. If you want more information, there's lots of it on the website, and if you click on that today, it's right on our homepage. If you want any more information about Bethany and what she's talking about, or are doing some consulting or workshops at your school, just contact us at the office, which is 800-424-9484. And with that, Bethany, take it away, please.
Thank you, Stephanie, and welcome, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. I began researching the topic of motivation several years ago. My interest grew out of the workshop that I was conducting on other topics, particularly a framework for understanding poverty, and the most frequently asked question was, okay, but how do we motivate the students? And I didn't have one perfect answer for that question. I had lots of smaller answers, so I began searching for the perfect answer. I was looking for an answer wrapped up in a gift box with a bow, but what I discovered was that this topic of motivation is multifaceted, it is complex, it is more like working a puzzle and picking up the pieces one at a time and twisting and turning them and trying to see if they fit and putting them back if they don't. But I have been able to extrapolate 9 main points, and these are the points that we'll cover today. The first point is that of basic needs, and I'm sure been treated with trust by other people. Another reason is their desire to fit in, which is really interesting. There's a body of research about our desire to fit in, and as we attempt to fit in, children will sometimes tell things that they think other people want to hear, rather than the child telling the truth as they know it. They might get into a habit of changing the story out of their desire to fit in. If we could imagine first grade Amy, by the way, and some of our stories will relate to older students, but for this example, let's think about a first grader. Her teacher says, "We will all now stand up one at a time and tell what we did during our vacation." Well, Amy took care of younger brothers and sisters all summer. She listens to one child tell about going to the mountains. Another child tells about going to the beach. Amy does not want to say, "Well, I spent my summer babysitting," so she makes something up. She says, "I went to China," or whatever works for her. And Amy develops this lifelong habit of saying what she thinks other people want to hear. Now, the reality is that after a few years of her changing the story and saying what she expects you and I want to hear, she begins to assume that we're doing the same thing. She assumes that anything that we tell her is not really true. And after a while, she does not trust anyone, and trust is making yourself dependent on other people. And if she has been belittled or made fun of or emotionally abused, then she is not willing to trust anyone else. When we think about the topic of delayed gratification, a very interesting study was conducted a number of years ago. Researchers put a marshmallow in front of a child and said to the child, "You may eat the marshmallow now, or if you'll wait 15 minutes, I'll bring another one and you'll have two. But if you eat this one now, you won't have the second one." Any of the children waited 15 minutes, others did not. And those who didn't invariably said, "Well, I just didn't think you would really bring the marshmallow." They just didn't trust other people to keep their word. And the reason this fits into motivation is because trust implies emotional safety. And without that emotional safety, children cannot be expected to attend to higher levels of information. We also need to remember that trust starts at zero, and it rises incrementally until a sense of trust is established. And then we reach the point of maintenance. However, one violation can make this level of trust plummet to below zero. And then raising it back up to zero requires almost Herculean efforts. It is difficult to reestablish trust. So in terms of strategies, and in this 1 hour, we, of course, will not be able to examine many of the strategies that are offered, but much of the discussion is about fairness. If students think we are fair and we're trying to be fair, then they will have a chance of learning to trust us. Something else that we can do, strategy number two, is to reduce the sense of competition in our classes. If you're not familiar with Think, Pair, Share and other cooperative learning strategies as opposed to focusing on competition, let's see who can be the best. There are various sources for finding those, but simply reducing competition is very helpful. Number one is fairness. Number two is reducing competition. Number three, and the final one we'll have time to talk about today, is that of nonverbal respect. We all give off as many as 240 nonverbal signals at any given time. So if we indeed lack respect for a child, or for his or her parents, by the way, we might try to conduct a meeting with the parent, hide our nonverbals. Well, we might think, well, I'll smile, I'll have my hands by my side, but that's just two. We're giving off 238 more, and people in poverty are often really skilled at reading nonverbal communication. So we might think we have done a really good job of hiding our intent if our intent is not positive. If my intent is to be the boss and to make this parent know that I'm in control, rather than having the positive intent of wanting to create a very beneficial relationship, then that parent who is skilled at reading nonverbals will know, even if we try to hide them. And that parent will go out into the community and say, "That was the rudest person I have ever met in my life." And we might think that we had a very successful meeting. So to review, in terms of basic needs, strategies that we can use are the many ways of creating fairness in the classroom, such as having procedures. Number two, reducing competition. And number three, being very concerned about our nonverbal communication. Okay? Moving on to key point number two related to motivation. Students from poverty have more difficulty developing intrinsic motivation. We sometimes hear people say, or teachers say, "I should not have to motivate my students. And we assume that everybody has intrinsic motivation if they would just use it. But the research tells us it's not quite that easy. In fact, intrinsic motivation was a topic that we didn't even find in the literature until after the 1940s. A professor decided he wanted to teach monkeys to solve a problem. So in order to acclimate the monkeys to cages. He put the puzzles in the cages a week prior to the actual research project was scheduled to begin. And he was shocked to discover that the monkeys didn't wait to be rewarded. They simply started working the puzzles. Until after the 40s, the 1940s, that the term intrinsic motivation was even used in the literature. And, of course, intrinsic motivation is wanting to complete a task for its own sake. Extrinsic motivation is completing a task for rewards or to avoid punishment. So a strategy, a major strategy that we need to keep in mind is simply helping students to internalize extrinsic motivation and to help them to develop an internal locus of control. I'm sure we've all worked with people who, when that person was successful, they would say, well, you know, this was an easy test. And when they failed, they would say, well, it was somebody else's fault. My teacher's not there. The test was too hard. If we can help these students to realize that the control over the situation is inside of them, then we can help them to become more motivated. And the research points out very clearly that most individuals with external locus of control come from families of low socioeconomic status because living in poverty involves stress and less control over their lives. So when we say, I've taught the material, they should be motivated to learn it on their own, we're not really acknowledging the fact that some of our students from poverty, frankly, have not learned how to be intrinsically motivated. Now, here's the good news. Praise can feed internal, intrinsic motivation. Extrinsic motivators can be internalized, and verbal praise is among the easiest types of praise of external, extrinsic motivation to be internalized, okay? One reason that many of our students have very negative internal feelings is that they have lived in households of negativity. Research tells us that the typical child from a professional household will hear 5 affirmations for every 1 discount. The typical child from a low socioeconomic household will hear 2 discounts for every 1 affirmation. So if we praise that child 10 times in any one school day, after that 10th affirmation, that child is at that point even with his or her more affluent peers. So some of our students absolutely need a great deal of praise just to be even and just to feel intrinsically motivated. Okay? Now, I realize that we are not completely exploring any of these topics. I regret that we don't have the time to do that, but as Stephanie said earlier, during the course that will be offered in November, we'll have more time to go into more detail. But for today, during this limited period of time, we've talked very briefly about basic needs, and students who do not feel safe in the classroom simply cannot attend to higher levels of information. We talked, number 2, about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, and the good news is that extrinsic motivation is not all bad. It can be internalized. Topic number three is that of goal setting. Motivation is generally defined as goal-directed behavior. Unfortunately, some of our students do not have the motivation because they don't have the goals. What we need to do is to help our students to establish goals. And when we talk to our students about goals, we need to talk with them about their possible positive selves. When you and I think about ourselves in the future, we see a positive person, and we see unlimited possibilities. Some of our students lack a future story. They lack goals. I worked in an inner city school about 2 years ago teaching reading to some high school students. one young lady appeared for class one morning. She was in the 10th grade. Her friends looked at her amazed and said to her, and asked her, "Why are you here?" She looked at them and said, "I came to school." They said, "We heard about your brother. Your brother shot himself last night. Your brother died, and you're in school." She said, "He was going to die anyway." Her family absolutely lacked a sense of future. They were living from day to day. And if we can simply help students to develop a future story, but there are stipulations about this future story. One is that the future story must require graduation from high school, because students can develop future stories, but the future stories that do not require graduation will not help them to advance. For example, I know a second grade teacher who asked her second graders to draw a picture of themselves 10 years in the future. She was trying to help them to develop a future story. Well, she shared with me that she forgot to explain that she wanted to see in their picture a picture of their high school diploma on the wall. One little girl drew a picture of herself pole dancing. So this teacher had to think really fast, and she said to the child, "Oh, so you like music. What else could you do with music? You could teach music, but in order to teach music, you will need a high school diploma first." So we must help our students not only to develop future stories, future goals, but those future stories must require graduation. Secondly, these future stories must be emotional. Some of our students might think, "Well, yes, I would like to become an airplane pilot," for example. But if they are not emotionally attached to that future story, they will not likely work toward it. I know of one teacher who worked with a student who said he wanted to make a lot of money. Well, he had very little emotional attachment to that goal. And one day she talked to him and she asked him what he would do with that money if he had it. He said, "I would take my baby brother to Disney World." So she had him at that point, from that point on. Whenever he talked about dropping out of high school, she would ask him, "If you drop out of high school, you will be much less likely to be able to take your little brother to Disney World. Let's stick with it, and let's get that diploma." And he did. So the future stories must require graduation, and they must include emotions. And also, they must be small enough. If we have a student in the third grade who simply wants to graduate, then we need to find one step that's not quite so far in the future, not quite 7 years in the future. So, once again, we have talked very briefly about basic needs, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, goal setting, and we'll move now to the topic of rewards or incentives. We have two key points. One is that verbal praise increases intrinsic motivation. So when we're thinking about rewarding students toward increased intrinsic motivation, we could think first of verbal praise. The research tells us that we as human beings think we praise people more than we do. I experienced this on a personal level a few years ago. I was listening to NPR. I was away from home. The announcer said, "If you want to improve your relationship with your significant other, simply praise him or her every day." I remember thinking to myself, "Gee, I praise my husband a dozen times a day." But when I returned home, I thought about that and paid him a very deliberate compliment. That evening at dinner, he stopped and said, "By the way, thank you for the compliment." And I suddenly realized that for him to recognize this compliment so vividly, apparently I had not been complimenting him as much as I thought. And I began to wonder how long it had been, 30 years since the wedding, nice suit, I don't know. But it had been a while. So if we use verbal praise with our students, then they will become intrinsically motivated. The second key point related to rewards is this. Extrinsic rewards can diminish intrinsic motivation. Back to the monkeys, we talked about a little earlier. The monkeys picked the puzzles up and walked them, and they never stopped. They just kept walking the puzzles until Harlow said, well, I'll go ahead with the research study anyway. I will reward the monkeys and see if they can work the puzzle faster. So he rewarded the monkeys for working the puzzle. Yes, they did increase in speed. But then, the very day that the research project finished, the monkeys were no longer rewarded. They stopped working the puzzle. They absolutely did not show any interest in the puzzles after that point. So, some researchers tried this with human beings. Nursery school children, for example, they gave group A, group B, pencils, paper, markers, and said, draw pictures. And they did. On the second day, they said to group B, children, we will pay you for each picture that you draw. On the third day, they gave both groups pencils, papers. Group A continued to draw. Group A had never been rewarded with cookies or money or anything. Group B, they said to the children, you may draw some more pictures, but this time you will not get paid. The children in Group B stopped drawing pictures. And we know that nursery school children are intrinsically motivated to color and draw. But after they had been rewarded and then the reward was taken away, they were no longer intrinsically motivated. Those in the control group, however, continued to draw. There are similar studies regarding graduate students, people from various fields, and most every study tells us that if the person is already intrinsically motivated to complete a task, and we start rewarding them, once that reward has been taken away, the internal motivation is at least temporarily extinguished. So the first word of caution regarding rewards is that if the child is already motivated, then extrinsic motivators can be detrimental. Verbal praise, of course, is very effective. However, if the task is of low intrinsic value, then a reward is acceptable. For example, if we want to reward a child for attendance, obviously the child is not intrinsically motivated to attend school. We can reward that child for attendance until the child has developed the habit. And this is an effective use of rewards. Students will respond to rewards if they feel that they have control over the situation. If we say to the child, I will reward you for attending school regularly, they can control that. Most of them can, so they respond positively. But if we say, however, we will reward you for improving your scores on this test, if they don't know how to do that, then the rewards can actually add to the frustration. So the good news is that rewards are not all bad, but we do have to be careful and use them appropriately. Okay, moving on. We've talked about basic needs, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. We've talked about goal setting, and we've talked briefly about rewards. Now, point number five is book clarification primarily, and that is volition. Technically, motivation ignites behavior. Volition keeps it going. So in your reading, as you read further about the topic of motivation, you'll want to be sure and run a search for volition as well. Some students will get started, but they will drop out along the way. And the strategies that we can use to keep them going include the good teaching strategies that we've been using for years, such as helping students to seek success rather than avoiding failure. If we use the extrinsic motivators and we look for success, this is much more effective in terms of volition than to say, if you don't do this, you will be punished. Another strategy that we can use is to teach students how to deal with distractions. We're all distracted, and those of us who have learned how to deal with distractions are more likely to reach our goals. A research study involved from young children who were asked to complete a task, that a clown would appear and try to distract them. Some students were taught how to avoid being distracted by the clown. The teacher said, now a clown will come through. Just ignore him. He's trying to get you off task. And the children who were taught how to avoid distractions completed their tasks successfully. Those who were not, did not. So this says to us that we can actually talk to our students about how to avoid distractions. I understand you stayed up late last night playing a video game, and now you don't feel like doing your work. Let's talk about how we can avoid this distraction, and this can be helpful for them. Okay. So, moving on, we will look now at topic number 6, and that is self-awareness. And self-awareness is important because some of our students behave in certain ways that are detrimental to their success, but they really don't know that this is happening to them. And we need to help them to understand that sometimes their behaviors are not acceptable behaviors in a school setting. For example, some of our students don't understand that they make choices. They get into trouble. They go home. They say to their parents, I was in school today, and I got into trouble. And some parents will say, well, I'm not surprised, you're just bad. Because these parents don't understand the concept of choice, and therefore the parents are not able to teach their children about choices. Parents who do understand will ask the children, well, what did you do? And what we as educators can help students to do is to generate other choices, other options that they had and other choices that they could have made. Okay, I saw that piece of paper fly out of your hand and you hit Susie in the head. Okay, what happened? Okay, Susie looked at you. I understand. So what else could you have done? And this helps children to realize that they, in fact, make choices. And it's not just us doing everything to them. We can also help students to understand that their ability is developmental. We can say, for example, this is an exciting time for our brains. More and more research is showing that our brains change constantly with learning and experience, and this takes place throughout our lives. Some children think they were born, excuse my term, but I've heard them say, I'm dumb, and some children think they were born with less intelligence than they would like to have. And if we can help students to understand that intelligence and ability are developmental, this can be more motivating than any M&Ms or cookies that we can give them. Just to help them to understand that Einstein wasn't Einstein until he worked hard. We can also help students to become aware of their emotions. If I were to ask you, which of the two following students is more likely to do well in school? Anna, who has an IQ of 140, or Charlie, who knows how to control his emotions? Assuming that Anna has less control over her emotions, the answer would be Charlie, because a student who is able to control his or her emotions has more possibility of being successful than students who simply have developed a great deal of intelligence. Okay, and now I'm talking really fast, so please don't hesitate to email questions if anything isn't clear. When we talk about emotion control, for example, we know some students who feel that their life is hopeless, and something bad happens to them, and they are dejected, they feel hopeless. We can say to them, for example, do you know, worse things could happen. This really isn't so bad. And to help them to learn to control their emotions, we can talk to them about sports figures and their favorite sports figure before throwing that basketball is saying to herself, stay calm, stay calm, stay calm. And we can do the same things. So once again, very briefly, We just talked about self-awareness, and this is helping the students to understand their behavior, how their behavior impacts themselves, how it impacts other people, and we've talked about volition, which is keeping motivation going. We've talked about rewards. Fortunately, rewards are not all bad. They just must be used appropriately. We've talked about goal setting. Students without a future story will not be motivated because they have nothing to work toward. We've talked about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, and the good news is that extrinsic motivation can be internalized. And we talked about basic needs. Primarily today, we talked about that of trust. So now we're on topic 7, that of competence and mastery. If you, any of you, were to ask me to complete a task, if I felt that I could be successful at this task, I would likely be motivated to get started. If, however, I felt as if I did not have a chance of being successful, I would not be as motivated to get started. And what we can do as educators is to, as we teach skills and as we teach knowledge, we can say to students, this is a skill that you can use not just in my class but in other classes as well. And this skill will help you to be successful in life. And when we think about knowledge, the number one bit of information that students need is a grasp of the power of vocabulary. Some students are clueless about the power of words. I was seated not too long ago on an airplane beside an 8-year-old Nathan. On the other side of Nathan was his grandmother. The airplane started to move, and Nathan got all excited. He said, "Grandmother, we're moving." She said, "Yes, we're taxiing." Later he said, "Grandmother, we're going up now." She said, "Yes, we have begun our ascent." Later he said, "Grandmother, look at how high we are." She said, "We have reached cruising altitude." Later he said, "Grandmother, when I grow up, I want to fly an airplane." She said, "You'll study aviation." Later he said, "Grandmother, we're going down now, and I'm sure there's a word for it." And he was right. There was a word for it, and she gave him the word. And little Nathan was acquiring an understanding of the power of vocabulary. When we think about teaching vocabulary, one thing we need to keep in mind is that we sometimes think that we can tell students to simply read, and as they read, they will acquire more vocabulary. This is true for some students, but not for all, because some students have not learned to focus on things in their environment. Some of you might suffer from this disability. I do. I remember not too many years ago, I returned from an extended trip. I parked my car. I went inside. My husband asked me, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "About what?" He said, "About the bulldozer." I asked him, "What bulldozer?" He said, "The one in the driveway, the one you just parked beside of." You know, he expects me to see everything. I did not see the bulldozer. And some of our students will come to school and they'll say, "I studied for this test. I'm ready." And they take the test, and we'll ask them, "Well, why didn't you answer this question about the chart?" And they'll say, "I didn't see it." And you'll ask them, "How could you have missed it? It covers 50% of the page." And they'll say, "I didn't see it." And the reality is that they likely did not see the chart, because without adequate mediation, some students simply do not learn how to see things in their environment. And these children will read a chapter or they'll read a book, and when they encounter an unfamiliar word, they never see it. They just blur right over it without focusing on it. Therefore, when we teach vocabulary, we must do two things. First of all, we must point out potentially challenging vocabulary words ahead of time and have them just complete a little checklist. Do you know this word? Yes? No? What do you think it means? And the purpose of this is not for us to know how many words they have already mastered, but the purpose is to say to the child, "You will encounter this word in your text. You must look for it." Otherwise, many of our students, especially students from poverty, especially students who are under-mediated, simply will not see the new words. So when we ask students to just read, and we're assuming they're increasing their vocabulary, that is not necessarily true for all of our students, at least not to the extent that we would like for this to happen. So we must show them the words ahead of time. Now, when we think of competence and mastery, we have talked about knowledge. We want our students to acquire knowledge, and vocabulary is a huge part of that. Secondly, we want them to acquire skills. We need to teach planning skills, for example. Some students will simply look at a task and never get started because they don't know what to do first. If we have never driven a car, we'll get into the car and we won't know what to do first. But we sometimes assume when we give students projects that they know how to get started, and often they don't. So we must teach them how to plan, and then we help them to understand that these planning skills will help them in this class, but they will help them in other classes as well. We also need to help them to understand that step one should probably be completed in a day, because some students don't understand this middle class concept of timekeeping. They're keeping time emotionally, and if they think step one is fun, if step one, for example, is choosing their favorite animal, that's kind of fun. So they'll choose their favorite animal for a week, 2 weeks, a month, and the night before the paper is due, they choose their favorite animal. And then they're surprised that they don't have enough time left to actually write their paper. And as middle-class people who keep time according to middle-class constructs, we can't understand why they didn't complete step one earlier. So when we help them to plan, we must help them to identify that first step and to decide how much time that step should take. Another skill that we can give our students so that they can master content is to help them to develop mental images. We won't spend a lot of time on this because Dr. Payne's work addresses mental models quite a bit. But as an example, if you would imagine a tree, if you have pencil and paper, you might want to just sketch a tree. We could say to students, do you know, this story that you wrote is interesting, but all you told me about your main character is that he is a man. I want to know more. Look at this tree. Leaves stand for his appearance. Tell me what the man looks like. The twigs stand for details. Tell me something that the man did that was just interesting. Is he right-handed? Is he left-handed? The branches stand for his actions. The trunk stands for his inner fears, and the soil stands for the location, etc. If we can give them mental images of skills, then we can help them to be successful. Okay, I know we're moving down to our last few minutes, and we're almost on the last step. Another skill that we can teach is for students how to get organized. And we simply can't say to the student, get organized. They don't know how, because we were not born with skills of organization. We were taught how to get organized throughout our lives. And we also need to teach children to need organization. I'm sure you all know people who need organization. I remember my husband, who was very middle class, by the way, when I was dating him many years ago, I was at his house one evening and asked him if he had a bobby pin. He said, I have one. He said, it is in the back left-hand corner of the upper right-hand dresser drawer. He needs organization. And only after we help our students to need to be organized will they be organized. And we can do this by saying, here's a cover sheet for your unit. You can see item number one might be notes. Number two might be your research notes. You will put this on top of your unit and check the steps off. Anything to help them to get organized. Finally, in this topic, we can give students rubrics. Rubrics help in many ways. Rubrics can help our students to believe that we're being fair. If I'm from poverty and I'm thinking, you know, life isn't fair, and you're my teacher and you give papers out and you give me a C, and the person beside me makes an A, if I just think, life is not fair, my teacher just doesn't like me, that's just the way it is. But with a grading rubric, you can say to me, compare your paper with this rubric. Decide how what would need to change about your paper in order for it to reflect a 5, which would be a perfect score. Then you're helping me to understand that you are trying to be fair. And rubrics can help me to acquire the skills that I need in order to master topics as well. Okay? We're down to our last two general topics. Number one is basic needs. Number two, intrinsic motivation, goal setting, rewards, volition, self-awareness, competence. We are now to relatedness. And our key point under this topic is that no significant learning occurs without significant relationships. I remember when I first joined Ruby Payne, Dr. Payne would flash the slide up saying no significant learning occurs without a significant relationship. And this is a quote from Dr. James Comer, by the way. I remember that I really didn't fully grasp, I didn't accept this. At the time, I was teaching full-time at a university, and when I started conducting workshops for Dr. Payne, I wasn't on campus as much. As time went on, I was on campus less and less, and my evaluation started to drop. Even though I was teaching my classes the same way I had always taught them, I was not in a position, I did not have time, I did not have the energy to build significant relationships, positive relationships with my students. And my students' perception was that they were not learning anything in my class. And this was one of the comments that they wrote on my evaluations. So I learned in a very difficult way that this is very true, that we need to create an environment of relatedness. We can do this by helping students to understand that successful people seek help. We should encourage help-seeking behavior. See, in poverty, the perception is that I must be strong. You can't survive in poverty if you're not strong. Therefore, if I think that asking for help shows weakness, I will not do that. So we have to say to our students from poverty especially, do you know what? Strong people, successful people seek help. There's not a person who was ever successful who didn't ask for help. Number two, we can appoint advocates for our students. Number three, we can use the adult voice, and these are all strategies that are discussed further in Dr. Payne's work. But we should also help our students to develop relationships between themselves and their peers. And this can be accomplished through cooperative learning as well. Finally, our final topic, and we have about 1 minute to talk about this before time for questions, is that of autonomy. And almost every research project that I read said, if we want to motivate our students, we should give them autonomy, and we should help them to develop competence. When we all want control, by the way. Surveys are conducted in the United States regularly to determine who in this country is happiest. Married men, married women, unmarried men, unmarried women. And every time when people self-report, the group that says, yes, I'm happy, the happiest group is that of married men. And the survey says that they report that they feel that they're in control of their lives and their decisions. The least happy group, unfortunately, is that of married women. And married women often report that they don't feel that they have control over their lives. The key point here is that the need for autonomy is one of the three basic innate needs identified by many researchers. So this takes us up to the 1:45 time. I realize that we simply touched on each of these topics, but I will happily address questions at this point. Stephanie, do we have questions?
Let's see. No questions have come through yet, so let me just remind people that if they have any questions, if they want to send them to us at questions@ahaprocess.com, we will try our hardest to answer those. Bethany, I don't know if you have an extra nugget while maybe someone's thinking about a question. If you have one, then we could discuss that right now.
Well, we could talk just a little more about autonomy because we talked about this very briefly. When we think of autonomy in the classroom, we are not saying that we should let the children run the classroom. We're saying that we can give them choices, and these choices can relate to content. What would you like to learn? They can relate to process, or they can relate to product. And I'm fully aware of the standards that we must address. But within those standards, there are opportunities for choice. For example, just a choice of topic for a research paper. And this helps the student to feel autonomy over content. There are other times that we can offer students choices over processes. How would you like to go about studying this topic? To have a child ask an expert, for example, instead of reading another book would be autonomy or choice within the process. And finally, the product. We often require students to write a research paper or to turn in a particular product. But choices might include a letter to the editor. It could include I can't think of the word that I'm trying to bring to mind. I do apologize. But we could have murals and art projects as opposed to the more typical products that we require of students. And I will share very quickly that I had the opportunity to teach for 10 years in a program, an experimental program, that had no set curriculum, and we did not have required products or processes. I know this opportunity doesn't exist in today's time with our teaching requirements. However, what I experienced was my 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th graders worked harder than they typically worked in the classroom. They chose more challenging topics. The processes that they chose were much more involved, much more challenging. They often visited with experts in the field, and their products were much more creative because they had some element of choice, some element of autonomy. And again, we know the restrictions in modern classrooms, but if we can search for those opportunities to help students to be autonomous, then we can help them to be motivated. Stephanie, I'll check with you before I continue to talk.
Okay. Yeah, we've got a couple of questions now.
Okay.
One person was just saying, can you talk a little bit more about volition? And thanking you for a great seminar.
Oh, great. This topic of volition is exciting, and we did not spend much time on this. We talked about volition primarily because I had researched motivation for months and months and months before I realized that I was missing a huge piece of the research, because in my mind, motivation was from start to finish. If I'm motivated to become a teacher, I finish high school, I go to college, etc., and in my mind, all of that was motivation. But the research separates motivation from volition. The research will talk about my goal of becoming a teacher as my motivation, but then sticking it out through high school, sticking it out through college, I can accomplish because of volition. And there's no hard differentiator in terms of how to ignite motivation or how to sustain volition, but the main reason we bring this up is because we don't want to miss this in the research. We want to be aware of the terminology. And there are ways that we can help to develop volition. For example, we can help students to develop positive attitudes. We know that some of our students in our classrooms have developed negative attitudes. And the reality is that they didn't do this by themselves. Other people helped them to become negative. And we don't want to say to them, of course, you're a negative person. But we can say to a student, do you know what? Yesterday, I heard you say something really positive about your English teacher, and I enjoyed hearing that so much. And you're becoming a very positive person, and I really like that side of you. Because our students who hear negativity day after day will become negative people, and they're not aware of it. And negative people simply are not motivated. They lack the volition to keep going. And we talked very briefly about dealing with distractions, but we can also help to help them to learn ways to remind themselves about their goals. We could give them a goal bracelet, just a simple chain, and you have 10 charms for your bracelet. Every time you reach a goal, you may add a charm, and this can help some students to make it through high school. I know high schools that have used this approach, and students have made it through simply to get those charms. So the charms are reminders of, okay, I reached this first step toward my goal. I hope that helps.
Well, and it's wonderful that you mentioned distractions, because that's the next question. The person said, could you please tell us more about how to teach students to avoid distractions?
Okay, thank you. What I read in the research is that successful people develop their own ways of avoiding distractions. Unsuccessful people often do not. So the first step is to simply talk about it, because those students who are unaware of the fact that, you know, I don't know how to avoid these distractions, other people do. Some students are unaware of this difference, so they just go through life unable to deal with distractions. They become distracted by video games. So step one is to simply talk about the fact that there are distractions. Things will distract you. You need to be aware of them. You need to deal with them. And then secondly, we can help them to brainstorm options. Do you know what? Tonight when you go home, the same distractions will be in your household. So what are some options? Is there another place that you can study? Or could you come into school early tomorrow? And we have to help them to brainstorm ways. We don't know their lives. We don't know their environment, so we can't designate ways for them. But the two steps that we see in the research are, first of all, an awareness, and secondly, a brainstorming of ways to handle the distractions. And again, this reminds me of the fact that when I started researching motivation, I was looking for that gold nugget. And what I found instead were paths that go in thousands of directions, one of which is this issue of distractions, which could be studied and have been studied by individuals for a lifetime. And what I'm trying to do is to pull together one or two of the most prominent strategies that I find in the literature. And these are the two that I have found.
Great. The next question is, could you just one more time run through the 9 main points?
I will be glad to. First of all, we think about basic needs. And once again, we're all familiar with Maslow. But when we think about basic needs through the lens of motivation, we realize the importance of trust. Trust is the one that we focus on, but the other basic needs are just as important. Secondly, intrinsic and extrinsic motivation and how they're different. And the point here is that we don't need to debate which is better, which is worse, because extrinsic motivation can feed the intrinsic motivation. We're not simply born with it. And some students live in environments where their intrinsic motivation has been fed. Number 3 is goal setting. If I do not have a goal, if I don't have a future story, then I have nothing toward which to work. I simply drift from day to day, and I live in the tyranny of the moment trying to get by. Number 4 is rewards or incentives, and the key points were, first of all, that verbal praise is a reward that is very effective for being internalized, for developing intrinsic motivation. Extrinsic rewards are not all bad. However, extrinsic rewards imposed on a student who is already intrinsically motivated can diminish that intrinsic motivation. So when we offer extrinsic rewards, we must keep in mind that our goal is to ignite a behavior. If that behavior is already there, then an extrinsic reward can have the opposite effect of what we want it to have. So extrinsic rewards can be used successfully, for example, for helping a student to realize, I need to go to school, because that child has control. Also, we should reward effort and as opposed to ability. I didn't talk about this, but there's some really interesting research about the fact that if we reward or praise ability, if we say to a child, you're so smart, then that child will try to protect his smartness. Gee, I'm smart. I won't accept any challenging tasks, because if I accept this challenging task and I don't do well, I won't be smart anymore. So we must reward effort rather than just ability. Okay. Number five is volition, and that, again, is what keeps motivation going, what keeps a person moving toward the goal. Number six is self-awareness, and this topic is really, really fascinating, because some of our students are totally unaware of their behaviors, of themselves, and they don't know their choices, they don't know their options, they don't know that they can increase their own abilities through effort. Number seven is competence. And when I researched, various researchers would identify, well, these are the three main motivators. The two that came up in every piece of research that I read were competence and autonomy. And if I don't feel that I'm competent, then I will not try. And we can say to students, when a student becomes good at something, we can say, I know you can do this. You're good at this. You're good at this. You're good at this. And we help them to feel competent. And we can say, this is a skill that will help you to do well. This will help you to master your work. And you can use it in every class. Number eight is relatedness. If we have a good relationship with a student, they'll do most anything for us. If not, they'll do nothing for us. And finally, number nine is autonomy. Give me a choice, and I'll feel motivated to work toward a goal.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Bethany. This has been just a fabulous teleseminar, and I have listened to a lot of teleseminars, and they're always really interesting, but this one was just terrific, so thank you so much.
I enjoyed it.
And again, if you've got any questions for Bethany, or if you need some other information, please do email us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and we will get right back to you. So thank you, everyone, for joining us, and thank you, Bethany, so much, and we will be in touch.